We're talking to a guest who says Americans should stop worrying about the fact that the West is no longer the dominant economic force that it once was.
He says the rise of the non-Western world is a good thing. Our guest is Charles Kenny. He's a contributor to Politico magazine and a columnist for Business Week. He's also the author of The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the West is Good for the West. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, this seems counterintuitive to a lot of people. There are a lot of people who think that the United States should be very concerned about their declining international status.
Yeah, and there are things to be concerned about in the United States when it comes to its international status, like the fact that it's dropping down the rankings in terms of school test scores, or that it's got one of the highest rates of inequality amongst rich countries, or that it's dropping down the life expectancy rankings. One thing really not to worry about is the fact that it's not going to have the largest economy for very much longer, and that last year it stopped being the largest trading nation. And the reason not to worry about that is while Washington hasn't helped when it comes to fostering growth in the United States and fostering trade, the big reason we've seen the rest of the world sort of take over on the top spot, and in particular China take over on the top trading spot, is because China, India, Brazil are growing a lot faster. And that's actually good news for the United States. It means, you know, more people to trade with, more places to invest, a safer and more secure world.
But what about the notion that there's only so much room at the top of the heap? There can only be maybe one person, maybe two countries at the top of the pile, and someone by necessity has to be at the bottom of the pile, and that it's looking increasingly like that's us.
Yeah, I think this is a case of sort of bad thinking in Washington about domestic politics infecting our views about the rest of the world. So it's true that if the Democrats are up, the Republicans are probably down, and if the Republicans are up, the Democrats are probably down. It's not the same when it comes to the international economy and international relations. There's not sort of just one top spot. We're actually in a partnership, and in increasingly important that we think of ourselves in a partnership globally. So, you know, we import a lot more from China than we export to China, but recently we've been exporting a lot more to China. And indeed, if you look at some of the stuff we're importing from China, like iPads, that, you know, a lot of the value in those iPads is actually U.S. value. So while in the trade statistics it looks like a big down arrow for the trade balance, you know, in fact, a lot of the value of the iPad obviously was created by Apple and sticks with us. If you look at other investment flows, China's investing in the States is investing in China. That's good for both of us. If you look at migrant flows, a lot of the innovation that's happening in U.S. companies is thanks to Indians, Chinese who come to live here for a while and invent stuff that, you know, we then get to patent and make money off of.
So
we can't think of these things as being a zero-sum game. This is a positive-sum game we're involved in.
So is part of your theory here that because as we develop more sort of, you know, economic relationships with different countries, that we have more sort of personal interest in sort of having a better world rather than war? Or what are you saying here?
I think that's true. That if you think about the way that the United States and indeed, you know, Europe used to look at the developing world, it was sort of in a charitable relationship, right? That we used to think of Africa and Asia as places we needed to help, that we needed to give money
right.
So that they could get a slightly better life. Nowadays, we still look at some places like that. I think we'd still look at Africa as a charity case, and that's increasingly mistaken because Africa over the last 10 years has seen six of the fastest 10 growing countries. But other countries, we stopped looking at as charity cases and started seeing them as huge threats, and, you know, that's China and India and Brazil and so on. And that model's a mistake, too, because they're not threats to us. They are potential and actual, you know, partners in making life better for Brazilians and Chinese and Indians, but also making life better for Americans at the same time. And so it's not just a case of sort of, feeling that we ought to be looking at the rest of the world and being more generous. We ought to look at the rest of the world and be more selfish. And the way we are more selfish is by partnering with them.
Now, is this any way, I mean, you're British, right? Is this similar to what happened in the UK as the British Empire sort of changed, or is there a difference here?
I should say, by the way, I'm a proud citizen of the United States,
right,
and a proud Brit, both from birth, and I consider myself incredibly lucky to have access to sort of all of Europe and all of the United States. And you know, I hope more people over time get to be as lucky as I am. I think that the United States can look at Britain as a bit of an example, that Britain kind of reached its nadir in the 50s and 60s as it gave up empire and, you know, found itself sort of without a role. I would say, though, that if you look at the quality of life in the United Kingdom after it gave up the empire, it shot up. So just a few years after Britain gave up, India and Africa, the Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was saying, you know, Brits have never had it so good. And he was absolutely right. If you look at, you know, income or health outcomes or education rates, you know, name your measure of the quality of life, Brits were doing a lot better than they were when they owned a quarter of the planet. So, you know, the link between global power and the quality of life at home, it has been weak for a long time, was weak in Britain, I think is weak in the United States. And so we really do have to sort of disconnect our ideas of what makes for a great life from being the largest economy.
What about the downsides? I mean, there must be some. We've enjoyed, it seems, so much influence on the world stage, economic and just in terms of international influence. Not being number one anymore, that's got to come with some downsides, doesn't it?
I'd agree. It's not going to be completely smooth riding, although, I'd say the benefits way outweigh the cost. But to take some potential downsides. So, at the moment, if you look at central banks around the world, a lot of the money they keep in their vaults in order to deal with financial crises and stuff is the dollar, a lot less than it used to be, but still the dollar is the major reserve currency. If you look at trading around the world, look at oil, for instance, it's traded in dollars. Now, over time, as the U.S. economy becomes less important, as it's already stopped being the largest trading economy, that's probably going to change. Having said that, a whole bunch of countries that have never had the world's reserve currency or never been in a currency where oil or other international goods are traded seem to be doing all right. So Luxembourg, which has an economy about the same size as Delaware, is also twice as rich in income terms per capita as is the United States. Now, you know, Luxembourg has never had a currency that has been globally dominant. So you don't need to have that in order to have a good life. It will take some transition, but I think the transition will be fairly easy.
We're talking with Charles Kenny, Politico magazine contributor and author of The Upside of Down, While the Rise of the Rest is Good for the West.
And we'll continue our conversation about the changing global economic landscape. We want to hear from you on this. Are you worried that the West seems to be losing its economic influence and dominance? Why or why not? Do you think it's a good thing that the rest of the world, certain countries especially rising up like China and India and Brazil, are becoming more economically sound, more important on the world stage? Call us and let us know what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation on how the rise of the rest of the world, including countries like India and China and Brazil, could be good for the West. We're taking your calls now and wondering if you're worried that the United States and the West in general seem to be losing their economic dominance. And do you think it's a good thing that the rest of the world is becoming more economically sound? Call us and let us know what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org.
Now, Charles Kenny, could you tell us if part of the issue here, the reason you're bringing this up, is because you think that the U.S. tends to spend more time thinking about remaining dominant when it should be thinking about other things?
I do think that's an issue. I think that the United States enjoys the idea of being biggest. But it's not actually, you know, a terribly important part of the quality of life in this country. That if you look at where the United States is on rankings of a lot of other things, including, you know, happiness as it might be, it's not number one. So being number one in terms of the largest GDP is not playing into being largest one, number one in a lot of other areas. And for most of U.S. history, this wasn't the dominant thing we cared about. I mean, if you go back to the founding fathers, what did they care about? They wanted to see a place where we could pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And that seems to be a much better thing to be focusing on, is how do we improve the quality of life here at home, rather than worrying about, are we number one, are we number two, are we number three on some, global scale of influence.
But earlier you talked a little bit about how the U.S. should be concerned about things like education and other issues that really do matter. And in some ways, doesn't the sort of competitive nature of wanting to remain number one, doesn't that sort of drive initiatives that actually could be good for the country?
Well, I guess apparently not, because we're not doing very well in international league tables on these other things like education and health. I think probably it's one reason why the U.S. defense budget is as large as it is. And I would say, by the way, that the United States plays a really important role globally when it comes to keeping the peace, not least keeping sea lanes open. On the other hand, it provides 0.03% of the troops involved in UN peacekeeping operations worldwide. So it's not, the only player when it comes to keeping the peace worldwide by any means. But I do think, we focus quite hard on making sure our military is way, way bigger than anybody else's military, and that might be a slight cost. So it's got upsides and downsides, this focus on remaining number one, and I think probably mainly their downsides.
We're talking to Charles Kenny about the U.S.'s status in the world, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Sandy from Algoma. Sandy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much. I actually feel relieved to know that this is happening. I think that the United States, for the last, certainly the last 20 years, has basically acted in a very imperialistic manner by pretty much using our military to support multinational corporations all over the planet, where we go into third world countries and we basically take control of their resources in one way or another. The John Perkins book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, really opened my eyes as to what we've been up to. And meanwhile, most of us had, I'd say the majority of us have had absolutely no idea.
Sandy, thanks for that call. Charles Kenny, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'm a little bit more positive on the U.S.'s role than that. I'm not to say that it's been perfect. I would say that the United States, especially in the 50s and the 60s, was vitally important in creating a world economic infrastructure that's actually benefited all of us. So the Global Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, that's now the World Trade Organization that governs world trade, was basically the United States at a time when, according to economic theory, it would have done better to sort of go its own in global trade and force its way on the rest of the world. Instead, the United States basically created this organization that means that small economies, small countries, have a fair shot at the global trading system. And, I think that was a really amazingly generous thing the United States did for the world. Similarly, with the International Monetary Fund, this is an organization that helps keep global stability. The only reason that the euro hasn't collapsed is because of International Monetary Fund intervention. That was a U.S.-led effort to create the International Monetary Fund. Neither of those organizations are perfect, but they played a really important role in making the world a better place for smaller economies. Of course, the irony, if you will, is that as the United States becomes not the global economy, globally most powerful economy anymore, those same organizations are vitally important to China, to India, to Brazil as well. And those same organizations are going to make sure that the global financial and economic system remains fair to countries like the United States that are no longer number one.
So what kind of response are you getting to your book and the writing that you're doing about this from people?
I think a lot of people, at least who I talk to, that's a biased sample, I guess, people who I talk to, broadly agree with the message. I think I would say two pieces of criticism I get, and I take them as being fair, is that one place where a growing global economy is not necessarily good for the United States or indeed for the planet is when it comes to the global environment. That if everywhere grows like the United States and Europe grows, and they all become as rich as the United States and Europe in the same way that the United States and Europe became rich, we will be pumping a huge amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and Atlanta will be toast. So there is a concern about sustainability. Now, I'm a bit more optimistic, perhaps, than some.
That, but you suggest that, I mean, I think you suggested in one of the things that I read from you because it's possible for emerging countries to do things in much more sustainable ways than the old days, that's been addressed a little bit.
Absolutely, and you know, thank you. Yes, so China, for example, is the world's largest consumer of solar panels nowadays, the world's largest producer as well, and that's some sign that already developing countries are developing in a way that is more sustainable than we used to. But we've still got a way to go on that, and it's not. You know, it is one of the issues we have to deal with if we're going to make a planet that is richer, healthier, happier, more educated, sustainably richer, healthier, happier, and more educated is the global climate issue.
I want to ask you about American exceptionalism, because that's something that the United States has used to justify lots of things. It has ticked off some people. It has pleased other people. But is the United States somehow exceptional in that by losing our status, we're losing more than just our place at the top?
The things that make America the absolutely wonderful country it is are things like the Constitution, like our respect for liberties, the quality of life here on so many dimensions. That's what makes America, you know, unique in many ways. I mean, I do think it's an exceptional country. Its sort of birth history is particularly unique. Those things don't go away if it stops being the largest economy. And indeed, I hope that when we stop fixating on being the largest economy, we can go back to thinking about what America is really exceptional about. And that'll be good for our economic growth in the long term, because increasingly what drives American economic growth is innovation. And a lot of that innovation is created by people who migrated here, who weren't born here, but came here because it's such a wonderful country. And so making America an even more wonderful country to live in is actually a really important part of our economic strategy going forward, remain rich and healthy and happy.
Is part of what you're making here an argument for diversity, both economic diversity and international diversity in our population?
Absolutely. I mean, again, America is a country, born on immigration, right? And the vast majority of people alive today in the United States are at least descendants of migrants. And I think that's a huge strength of America. And that migration and that diversity has made the country, you know, richer and a more interesting and a better place to live. So I do absolutely. Part of the story is preserving that, strengthening that as a way to make sure that America remains, you know, the wonderful place to live that it is for, you know, the vast majority. Not to say that it couldn't be better, and you know, inequality is a huge issue, and poverty is a huge issue. But still, you know, by and large, it's a great place to live.
We have a comment from James on Facebook. He says, all dominant powers must one day go from leading roles to smaller parts. The question is, do we want to bow out gracefully or be dragged kicking and screaming? Which way do you think the U.S. is going right now?
I wish he had been my publicist. That is a beautiful way to put the book. So I worry a bit that there's kicking and screaming going on. I mean, for example, just in the last couple of days, the Congress, in its wisdom, decided that it wasn't going to provide the U.S. part of the money required to make the International Monetary Fund stronger. Now, again, the International Monetary Fund sounds like an obscure organization, but it's actually been really important in making sure that the financial crisis wasn't worse than it already was. And the U.S. Congress is saying, yeah, we're not going to give any money to it. So at the moment, it seems to be we're going there, yeah, we're annoyed with the rest of the world and we're not going to play nice with them. And I really hope that that attitude switches around to one of, you know, gracefully accepting second, third place.
Does the partisan nature of domestic politics in the U.S., though, make it more difficult for the U.S. to approach things that way?
Yes, I think so. Basically, we have this problem, which is, you know, although if there's one thing we're kind of bipartisan about, it's not really liking playing nice with multilateral institutions like the World Bank, the UN, and the IMF. In a way, that's popular on both sides of the aisle. But I do think it does make it worse. It makes it harder for people to come together and think, you know, what's in the long-term interest of the United States, and instead they sort of go back to name-calling. I do think it's fascinating that nobody in Congress is talking about the fact that the United States days as the biggest economy are extremely numbered, and it's already lost its top spot on trading. And I think it's because people are scared to say that. It'd be, oh, that's defeatist, you know. And that's just, if we can't get out of that mindset, that's a real problem.
Well, thanks for talking with us today, Charles. That was Charles Kenny, Politico magazine contributor and author of The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the West is Good for the West.